这本是书。
肯定是你。
Hello everyone, can you hear me at the back? Yeah, great. Welcome to the London Review Bookshop to celebrate the publication of Multiples, published by Portobello and edited by Adam Thirlwell. To call it an adventure in translation would be an understatement. The book contains 12 stories in 18 languages by 61 authors. We couldn't fit all 61 authors in tonight, but we've had a good go. And we're very lucky to have everyone here tonight. But rather than introduce them all now, I'm going to hand over to the book's editor and this evening's Master of Ceremonies, Adam Thirlwell, who will briefly explain the idea behind the book and the format for the evening. Before I do, I just have to say, please watch your wine glasses. Excellent, excellent timing, sorry. Please watch your wine glasses on the floor when you leave your seats later on. And the fire exits are here and here, sorry, contractual obligations. Anyway, with no further ado, please join me in welcoming Adam Thirlwell and Team Multiples.
Thank you very much. This mic's working. It's all right. What I want to do is very, very fast, because as you can see, we've got about 700 writers to get through. I'm going to very quickly explain this quite crazy project and then explain how this evening is going to work. This project called Multiples sort of began basically when I had this idea that I would quite like to do something that would contradict the normal way in which translation was talked about, which was that translation is always seen as basically a failure at every point, and so people always want to bring up the untranslatable words. And in opposition, I thought it'd be fun to kind of somehow do some experiment, like a stunt, that would be so crazy and seemingly so dangerous for any kind of survival of poetry or meaning or anything. But that somehow, at the other end, things would emerge. And so the idea I came up with was a kind of Chinese whispers in literary form, where one story would get translated in a sequence, in and out of English, so therefore where only the original translator actually was doing what people normally think of as translation, i.e. translating the original text, and everyone else was working at two or three or four removes from the original. The other kind of constraint I added in was I refused to ask actual trained translators who might well know the language, and instead asked only novelists, some of whom had very good knowledge of the language they were translating from, and some of whom Joe Dunthorne didn't. So that is the, in a nutshell, that is the basic project. I'm having to go very fast because of the evening we've got ahead. And so my idea, so that you get a flavour of this, because we ended up with 12 stories, often being iterated about five times, is we've got three pairs basically here. So we've got three stories which were translated, and we've got two of the sequence for each of the story here. So what we're going to do is kind of go story by story, and then where each person is going to read out just a page, just to give you a flavour of their translation. Then each translator can have a mini argument amongst themselves about whose translation is best. And then hopefully there'll be time for a more general discussion, and then questions, furious responses from you. And so the first translate, and then the other thing I should explain about the project is the choice of the originals. Although technically I am the editor of this, really that means I was the emailer. I was just the kind of email inbox. And so in terms of the originals, it's true that I chose a few and I kind of thought, oh, X would be really brilliant for this. But in some cases, it was from a language I had no idea about, and so I left it. So David Mitchell, for instance, who speaks Japanese, I said to him, choose whichever story you would like to translate. So I was not responsible for the particular Japanese story. In the same way, Zadie Smith had agreed to translate something from Italian, but neither really I or Zadie is that expert in Italian literature. So we asked our friend Francesco Pacifico, who is one of the translators as well, a novelist, Italian novelist and critic, and translator, to choose. So what I'd like, Francesco, do you have the roving mic? You have the roving mic. I want Francesco to explain a little about this author, Giuseppe Pontigia, who is the author of this story, of this first sequence.
Hello. I don't think I'm going to introduce Giuseppe Pontigia, who died about 10 years ago and was a good writer. I'm going to say something about the choice. Before Pontigia, I chose another writer who's living and whose name I won't mention. He's a very distinguished experimental Italian writer. And something that happens often with Italian experimental writers is that when you translate them, everything fizzles. It just disappears. All the allure, all the glamour just disappears. We seem to have no content at all. We just like to play strange board games with words. So, and that was Zadie's reaction. He said that, like, the story you sent me doesn't make any sense. Sadly, the living writer had already been told that his story was going to appear on McSweeney's, and someone had to...
I had to tell him.
That's why he's the editor. I laughed a lot, and so I decided to go for a dead writer, which was better in case Zadie wasn't going to like the second story too. But actually, it's a story that lends itself well to an English translation because it's very plain, and it's about an average man and a man who visits brothels and gets rejected by a priest in the sense that he wants to... after his doubts to a priest, and the priest is rude to him. So I thought it was going to be good in English, and Zadie did a very good work. And you wanted to...
Yeah, the one thing... Well, actually, maybe we'll come to that after we've done the readings. So I'm just going to very quickly, since Zadie's not here, I'm going to be Zadie. And so I'm going to read just her first couple of paragraphs. What then happened in that sequence is it was put into Chinese by Ma Jian, sitting here. So Marjan's then going to read his first page. So for your Chinese speaking, that will help. And then it was translated by Tash Orr here. And so Tash is then going to read the equivalent page back into English. So we'll start then with Umberto Butti, translated by Zadie Smith. And it has an epigraph from J.R. Wilcox's The Book of Monsters. It's true, like all mammals, it has two eyes, a nose, a mouth, and somewhere four limbs. And it begins like this. He is born in Empoli on the 30th of April, 1931, son of Stefano Butti, holder of a degree in chemistry, and of Concetta Valori, a mathematics teacher at the Technical Institute. His father, director of the Osveco firm, it produces thermal valves, has published 3 literary articles and 5 rather minor editorials in Livorno's Telegraph. He often claims to have sacrificed the lettered life for 2 + 2 = 4. He still recalls those Greek and Latin verses of his school days, declaiming them with all the sonority of an auctioneer. He asks his son to name their authors, and each time his son denies all knowledge of them. He dedicates the same attention to modern poetry. He is like a spectator in the gallery, always ready to boo or applause in a manner usually reserved for the efforts of opera singers. For poets, he lies in wait. He has an unbounded admiration for D'Annunzio, whose lyrics he calls sheet music.
I'm going to give a very short reading to the 2 people who understand Chinese.
This is 一个鼻子，一张嘴，以及长在不同位置的四肢。关于怪物，Verkirk 1931年 4月 30日，田怀义出生在战乱的中国南部城市广州。他的父亲田树林是留学意大利的化学博士，母亲朱丽叶出生在佛罗伦斯。去年随丈夫来到中国，在离家 不远的技工学院当了数学教师。父亲是在一家叫 Scaro 的意大利公司任销售主管，主要产品是进口的热力阀。他热爱文学，思想活跃， 还在广州日报上发表过三篇文学评论和五篇他翻译的意大利诗歌。
Okay, I'm going to read approximately the same passage. But before I start, can I just say my translation is actually very faithful and very respectful. So this is what I read from Ma Jian.
Just give the new title.
The story is now called Tian Hua Yi. This is the absolute truth. Like all mammals, it has two eyes, a nose, and a mouth, as well as long, unevenly placed limbs. That's from On Monsters by J.R. Wade Cook. Tian Huaiyi was born on the 30th of April 1930 in the war-torn southern Chinese city of Guangzhou. His father, Tian Shulin, had studied for a doctorate in chemistry in Italy. His mother, Juliet, a Florentine, had followed her husband to China the previous year and had found a job as a mathematics teacher in a technical skills institute not far from where they lived. His father worked as a sales manager for an Italian company called Scala, whose principal product was imported thermal valves. He was passionate in his love of literature and ideas and had published in the Guangzhou Daily 3 pieces of literary criticism and 5 Italian poems in translation. He often bemoaned the fact that he had sacrificed his literary aspirations for the everyday monotony of his thoroughly commercial job. And whenever he reflected on his life, he would become nostalgic for his time as a student in Italy, when he used to recite lines of poetry aloud, as bright and clear as the ringing cries of brokers in an auction house. He often tested his son on the names of these poets, but of course, each time, Tian Huaiyi would simply gaze out of the window at the rivers and hills beyond and shrug his shoulders. Needless to say, this response scarcely added to his father's feeling of self-worth.
Thank you very much. I realize I very rudely failed to introduce Flora Drew, who is Marjan's translator. I suppose the first thing that is obvious is that Marjan has entirely changed the setting of this story. And so, Marjan, I just wanted to ask, why did you decide to change the setting?
Yeah.
So as soon as I read this story, it struck me at once that it had a very Chinese feel about it, the sense of isolation and coldness about it.
第二个想法，我就想，作为这个翻译的话，我能否让它在中国还是变成一个有灵魂的、一个活的东西？
So immediately I wanted to transplant this story to China, but to try and find a way to make it, to allow it to retain its spirit, its soul. If that could transplant as well.
我想保持这个小说的这个时间不变，比如说 1937年、1989年、1945年，我想让时间不变。
I wanted to keep the structure and the chronology, these very important dates, that 1931, 1989, which in China also are very important.
但是我想，虽然这个地球是一个圆的，但是这面发生的事情跟这面发生的事情。
So that although the globe is round, but events that happen on one side can be very different from those that happen on the other.
所以我就把这个田怀义这个角色，还带着一点意大利，因为它是一个混血，一个杂种，带着意大利的风格进到了中国。
But I wanted the main character to be allow him to retain some of his Italianness. So he becomes a mixed race. His mother is Italian. His father has studied in Italy, and his name itself, Huaiyi, is nostalgic for Italy.
And in terms of I should say that I was incredibly free as an editor. I simply said to everyone translating that they needed to produce what they would consider an accurate copy that was also a live story in the original, so I was completely useless at giving them any parameters.
Can I just point out that I actually received fewer instructions than that? I just my instructions are simply just translate.
And in terms of translation, I'm interested in your in the actual book. Not everyone, but most of the translators have offered a mini commentary on what they were doing. And in your commentary, Madan, you say it's made me question how much characters are shaped by time, place, and language. And I think one of the interesting things for me is in changing, you mentioned that there are very meaningful dates in Chinese history, but in the Pontigia, I'm assuming, Francesca, that they're not meaningful dates at all in Italian history, that they're deliberately unimportant. And so what's interesting to me is that the transposition of place actually changes the meaning of the story, because suddenly it becomes very much a political story about why is this person avoiding the great events of the time. So I suppose my question is, how far do you think the character can be transposed without changing the meaning or without losing translation?
So you brought it to China, you said you need to study how a person is affected by his time, his culture is affected. So you brought it to China, you very clearly see those times, you can't avoid it. 89年在中国是很重要的一个时候，但是在意大利这可能这个就没有什么意义。你觉得最后你觉得这个在中国是没有办法避免历史和政治？
我觉得这个原来这个小说它有一个好处，就是它其实是故意的脱离了时代，比如说二战发生在小说里并没有出现。
So it seemed like in the original, it seemed to deliberately avoid the political context. There was no mention, for example, of any world wars. It happened, it took place in a void.
但是在中国有个最大的特点，就是每一个个人，他的所有的行为必须跟另一个人，跟一个社会是被连在一起，他很难单独逃离出来。
But in China, it is impossible for an individual to cut himself off from the wider, from social relationships, from the wider political context. Like, you can never be a lone man in China.
所以在这个翻译的过程中，大家知道我现在只能掌握是一个语言。我是通过Google先大概的看一下这个小说的这个故事结构，然后Fora给我读，读了以后我知道这个小说的文体，它的节奏快慢。那么在这个情况下，我是慢慢的进入了这个小说。
但是那个时代的风格是不能变的。
时代的风格是必须跟进入到中国的这个时代。
So inevitably the Chinese political context crept into the story.
And Tash, in your introduction, actually, I think a theme that kind of crops up a lot in these commentaries is the difference that various novelists felt if they were translating a dead, very famous person like Kafka, a dead, very unknown person, a very alive, very well-known person, or an alive, unknown person. And Tash, you actually, very early on in your commentary, you say, well, one of my problems was how to translate a well-known living writer like Ma Jian. You decided to therefore translate You Tell Me, relatively faithfully. Do you now regret that? Do you wish you'd completely rewritten it?
No, because I wasn't confident. I mean, I knew that there had been some big changes, but I didn't know what those changes were. And I was afraid that if I took further liberties, then it would totally become this mush of incomprehensibility. And actually, I loved the story. I loved sensing what Ma Jian had done to it. And I loved going along with those changes. I think that if you translate a dead writer, a dead well-known writer who is much translated and who has many versions of translations, I think it gives you a certain liberty to do something really different and do something really playful. I didn't feel I had that liberty. I thought that Ma Jian's work still needed to be sort of fixed in some way to provide some sort of English language
canon.
Although
one thing you do mention is that you changed the tense.
Yes, I did change the tense.
So Ma Jian's version is in the present tense.
Although in Chinese it's very fluid, you can...
There
are no tenses.
Yeah, I mean, I also sense that...
Was the original in the present tense? Can you remember? Zayd is...
I would say,
Zayd is in the present tense.
I sense that whatever... I mean, I knew that I had come from an Italian. I thought that it would probably have been done in... I don't speak Italian, but if Italian is anything like French, the present tense works in a much more fluid way, and as it does in Chinese. But I just needed, I thought that it hadn't, because of the time scales and the chronologies, it needed a much more epic scale and epic feeling. So I changed it into the past tense, which I thought fixed it a little bit more.
Because I think this is a theme that I think we'll keep coming back to, is the problem of maybe sometimes to be accurate, you actually have to change something. That's the kind of paradox that we'll keep going to. I think we now need to move to...
One thing about what Majan said, the absence of politics in that story is screaming something that is very recognizable for an Italian reader. It's something that is called qualunquismo. It can't be translated, of course. It's like whateverism or averageism, something like that. And the fact that he's bridging the gap between the fascist era and the democratic era, like effortlessly, is something that is central to the story. So what you said is not like.
So in fact, it is.
So the change is really meaningful.
It doesn't change the meaning as much.
Well, but. You bring that up, whereas in the story is this ghostly absence that an Italian can detect, but maybe in a literal translation no one would have detected. Yeah. I mean,
you leave. So we're now going to move to a new story. This is why we have to have these musical chairs. Hang on. So it's now you. Thank you. So we now move on to a new story in this sequence. This one was not my choice. This one was because I wrote to Javier Marías, the Spanish novelist, saying, would you like to take part in this project? And Javier wrote a very lovely letter back saying, yes, but I'm too busy. So he then said, however, you may be interested in this. And so a long while ago, Javier had written a book called Cuentos Únicos, where they were all translations of very, very minor writers that only Javier knows about from sort of early 20th century and late 19th century British literature. One of them he actually made up himself, and it wasn't this one, he assures me, although I'm slightly dubious. And this is a story, so this is the only English original in the entire book, and it's by a guy called Richard Middleton, who... In Javier's introduction, which could be pure fiction, he says that Richard Middleton was born in 1882 in Staines and died in 1911 after committing suicide with chloroform in Brussels. And so he was a very minor writer, basically, of ghost stories and lurid stories. And the story that Javier gave us is this incredibly lurid sort of B-movie of a story. And so I'm going to read just the very first couple of paragraphs of it so you get a flavour of this Edwardian, I think probably Will McSweeney will be the first people to have published since it was ever first published in, I think, 1934. And just to explain the sequence, that was then the English version had therefore obviously already been put into Spanish by Javier. Andrew Sean Greer translated Javier's Spanish back into English. That was put into German by Julia Frank. Antonia Byatt translated Julia's German into English. That English was put into Hebrew by Orly Castle Bloom, and then Adam Folds translated that back into English. This is one of our longest sequences, in fact. So I'll just read the first couple of paragraphs of the story called The Making of a Man. He was a weedy clerkling, and he had missed his way to Vauxhall Station in the middle of the night, and was now walking timidly through sordid but singularly unfrequented streets. He was afraid he was missing his last train, but when a stray figure did approach him, he lost his nerve and did not ask the way. He thought it might be a thief. At the same time, he knew that the soaking rain was spoiling his only overcoat, and the thought made him miserable. Why had he not gone to Waterloo, as Murray had suggested? Why had he omitted to borrow an umbrella? Why were there no policemen? He noticed with relief, however, that as he walked along, the houses were improving. They were getting larger and more respectable, and he hoped he might be approaching a main street. Presently, he saw a lighted window shining on the first floor of one of these houses, and as he neared it, the front door swung open and displayed a woman who leant out curiously to peer at him. Simmons was relieved when he saw her sex, because he was not afraid of women. He was very young.
So I'm...
I'm slightly surprised by how close this is. This is out of the German translation of the English.
Of the Spanish.
There he was, an unremarkable little clerk in the middle of the night, haplessly trying to find Vauxhall Station, lost in a labyrinth of mean and twisting streets. He was increasingly afraid that he had missed the last train. But even the thought of asking anyone for directions froze his nerves. Any passerby could turn out to be a thief. And as the state of his nerves deteriorated, he noticed how the rain was soaking the cloth of his coat, saturating it, ruining it. That really upset him. He worked in the drapery department, and so took great care to be smartly dressed. Why on earth had he not gone to Waterloo, as Murray had told him to? Why on earth hadn't he brought an umbrella? And why on earth were there no policemen anywhere? But as he hurried on, things changed. The houses became steadily more elegant, larger and smarter. The unremarkable little clerk calmed himself with the hope that surely, maybe at the next corner, he would now find his way. Suddenly, he saw a small light burning. It was in a window on the first floor of one of those houses. No sooner had he turned toward it than the front door opened. A woman appeared, framed in the opening, and looked intently at him. What luck, what a relief for Simmons to have come across a woman. He wasn't afraid of women, although he was very young.
Okay, so mine, as any of you could now tell me, is out of the Hebrew, out of the English, out of the German, out of the English, out of the Spanish, out of the English. But that doesn't quite accumulate to a justification of how wayward this version is. This version is called Manhood Strophes. One, it is a question of the separation and joining of bodies, first one and then the other. Two, for example, after his fear of being lost, of poverty and lack of law, comes his anger. The rain is soaking his coat. The wet world penetrates the fine personal fabric. This, quotes, infuriated him. Three, he turns a corner. That's better. Money engorges property. Homes enlarge and separate. They are proud. There is space between them. That's much better. Four, in the darkness, a light coming on like a new thought, which is the body of a woman. The body of a woman in a doorway is a doorway. Five, for the achievement of manhood, words are not essential matter. They are link work, ligature, and conveyance. Excuse me, madam, would you kindly tell me the way to Vauxhall Station? Are you a medical student? A medical student? No, I can see that you aren't. Is there anything that I can do for you? Yes, there is. I need help desperately. There, that's done. In through the door.
I suppose we should say what this very short story is about, is that he ends up going upstairs where he has to dismember the body of her dead husband.
We don't know
if it's the husband.
A man.
In exchange for a kiss and maybe more. We don't know.
I think she offers a lot more.
She offers a lot more.
She says, anything you want, that's more than a kiss.
He only takes a kiss, though.
That's the beginning.
He's very young. And so there's one detail that I want to mention purely. It has no real importance, but in Antonia's commentary, she mentions that she was so that she decided to get a new dictionary to help her with certain words, and that she was so enraged by the Oxford English Pocket Dictionary that she bought that she wrote her only Amazon review. And so I wanted to see if this was true. So this afternoon I had a look, and it is indeed there. It's the only 2-star review of the Oxford English German Dictionary. And I should assure you that the majority of the 11 reviews are all 5 or 4-star. So Antonia's is the only bad review.
I did have the previous edition of the same dictionary, which did have literary words in it. This one is purely practical. It would be very good if you were a student trying to cross Europe, and absolutely useless if you were trying to translate a good short story.
Antonio, I want to start with you, that especially after listening to Adams, what you say in your commentary is that you believe that a translation should be as closely as possible a rendering of the original text. And I want to actually start with the title. The title of Julia's is Man Werden, and you translate that as manhood, so you turn a verb into a noun. Can you
I don't think that
yourself?
Matters very much. I think what Julia is saying is he is now becoming a man. You can't call a story becoming a man, it's just ugly. But if you call it manhood, I think it means the same thing. I spent a lot of time thinking about it. I do actually, with respect to Adam, believe that the original writer owns the text in some way, which I think a lot of the translators don't. I think writing is one thing and translating is another. And through Julia's German, I got a sense of the English and the Spanish. And Javier Marías loves that period, and I could feel that period of English. And I did use words that belong to that period and which I would not now use. So I was doing my best to produce the kind of thing I thought Javier Marías had read. And I think, I got it fairly right as to what kind of story it was from what kind of thing. When I was a girl, my parents had a magazine called Argosy, in which endless, really pretty good short stories were endlessly published. And some of them were by major writers and some of them were by good working writers, because at that time there was a market for short stories, which there now on the whole isn't. And I knew I was translating one of those. And I wanted to make it look like the ones I read in bed at the age of about 7 from Argosy.
One of the questions I had was about, I think one of the kind of points of this project in a way was to try and analyse, in one sense, all a translation is a series of minute decisions on sentences. And yet, I suppose the kind of game of this project was to sort of say, well, maybe actually something, even if almost there's a mistake in every sentence, that the original will somehow survive. And I'm kind of interested because if we take the, and he was very young, I noticed that in fact in the original it just says he was very young. There's no, it's just a sentence on its own. And Julia, and Andrew Sean Greer says he was after all very young. Then when Julia translates it, she actually translates after all as obvol, which is in fact although. And so that adds actually, it's interesting, do you think that the although changes the meaning?
It does a bit, yes. But I still think that the meaning comes through more or less as the original writing was. I don't think anything serious happens to it in the previous English version. I think, listening to all this, I think Julia's is slightly more formal.
Than the original.
Than the original. And I guessed that the original was slightly chattier than Julia, but I was translating Julia.
Because you talk about a similar moment in your commentary, that there's a quite ghoulish moment where she asks Simmons to put on the dead man's clothes. And the original says, and they look at each other, And in the original, Middleton writes, and of the two, hers was the greater wonder, which Maria says, y de los dos, el de ella era el mayor asombro. I don't speak Spanish, by the way, so I've no idea if that was how you pronounce it. Andrew Sean Greer translated that, and would you guess it, she was more astonished than he. Which Julia says, und ahnen sie wie, sie staunte mächtig, which you translated as, she was horribly shocked. And you say you had a huge problem. Could you...
I did have a huge problem, yes. I didn't know what she meant by sie staunte mächtig.
You mean by... What you mean, you didn't know what she was shocked by?
No, I didn't know quite the weight of the shock. Right. It sounded perfectly all right in German. But I couldn't work out a translation for mächtig. I understood it. But I couldn't... No, it's just mächtig. Sie staunte mächtig. She was very shocked. But mächtig is stronger. It's mightily. She was mightily shocked. But you can't translate it that way because it's not that sort of story. It's not that sort of prose.
Yeah.
So I really did have trouble with it. I found it as an interesting thing about translation. If you write it down as literal as you can and then go away for 2 days and write something else, when you come back to look at it, you can work out which things you can fiddle with and which things have to be left as close as you can get them to what original you think you're reading, which in this case wasn't very. I mean, but it actually wasn't bad. I don't know what you think. I think all the versions are quite like each other until we reach Adam. But I can't read Hebrew.
So to bring us to that, why did you decide on this?
Partly it's because you asked me to. My Hebrew is, such as it ever was, is very decayed. So I learnt it 20 years ago. And so the process that I undertook was I met up with an Israeli who spoke very good English. And together, one morning in a cafe, we went through Orly Castleblum's text, and she kind of spoke, improvised a translation, which I noted down, and I wanted to keep that as kind of informal and as flexible as possible for me to then kind of engage with a fairly kind of malleable text. As it turns out, what occurred is the proof of what we've been hearing about this project a number of times, which is that translation is actually a very robust process, and this kind of off-the-cuff translation that we came up with together was very like the translation that you made, which felt kind of unsatisfying on some level. So in kind of conversation with you via email, the decision kind of arose to exacerbate the idea that translation is an act of reading, which is an act of interpretation. So what I then undertook to do was to make a kind of, this is also partly incited by the kind of rather inchoate nature of this text, is that I kind of analysed it and I patterned in a way that I found more satisfying for myself than I did in the text itself, the kind of the imagery and the meaning of the text. It's like a kind of crystallography of this, what's going on in the text, and I make strong interpretive decisions, and I make them very overt, and in a way it kind of exposes a thought process that translators might have, but would be buried beneath the surface of the act of translation.
And because one of the interesting things about your version is that actually it seems to me the real weird, you're almost rewriting T.S. Eliot is what's going on. It's very much, it seems to me, engaging with the early poetry of Eliot, so it's kind of Prufrock and the Wasteland. Is it purely just the period, or was there another reason why you felt that Eliot was the right medium?
It occurred to me to do, and I couldn't, and I was in a mood where that was kind of enough to some extent. I mean, it made, it made, it was a way for me to get a hold of this text. Part of that interpretive process is me kind of putting it in the constellation of things that I know, and that does that in quite an extreme way. So there's stuff in the story about the sea, and I take that on a step further, and I make that specifically about Margate, which is mentioned in The Wasteland. There's those famous lines, on Margate sands I can connect nothing with nothing. And that seemed to me it's kind of possibly a cheap way of doing it, but that is part of my wanting to kind of deepen my sense of the text.
And my last question on this, do you feel that on now reading the original, as it were, as much the original you can read, do you think that there's, as it were, something has survived in your... Do you think there's the tone, as it were, that you've made up in your version is linked to the tone of the original? Or do you think, in fact, they're nothing to do with each other?
I feel secure about my interpretation of it, but I would not impose that on Middleton. But so it's true for my understanding of Middleton's text, but it's not... give it to Middleton as his, if that makes sense.
What did you think of Adam's version when you read it?
It frightened me. because I do have this deep belief that writing is more important than translation. And that it is the duty of the translator to get as close to the original text as he or she can. You, however, has made this impossible for us. It wasn't Adam who made it impossible. It was you with your game. As a game, it's very nice.
Yeah.
But as a way of life, it's terrible.
Yeah. I think
with that, you should leave. we come to our last pair. Okay, so the last story of the night. This one, the original, was written by an Arabic writer, a Lebanese writer, Yusuf Habji al-Ashkar, who was born in 1929. And again, I didn't choose this story. I asked Rawi Haga to choose something from Arabic that he knew hadn't been translated. And so he chose this, and he wrote... for those of you who are going to buy the book, you will then discover more about Yusuf Habji al-Ashkar, because he wrote a very interesting introduction to his biography. And basically, he describes him as the first contemporary Arab existentialist writer. And so Rawi sent me his, what I presume was very faithful version of the Arabic in English. That was then sent to the French novelist Tristan Garcia. Tristan's version was sent to Joe Dunthorne. Joe's version was sent to Francesco for Italian, and then Venda La Vida translated Francesco's Italian back into English. So, as normal, I think I'll just read just the first couple of paragraphs of Rawi's version, so you get a vague idea of what it should have been in the original, and then we'll move on. So this was called The Four Seasons Without a Summer, first season. The coffee shop is spacious, with comfortable chairs and tables made of walnut wood, or possibly formica. Secretly, I stroke the table without letting the waiter, leaning against a marble column, see me. The table is smooth, it's formica, no matter how carefully the wood is polished, traces of death are still present at its edges. The bar's long and ends with the coffee machine. The waiter distances himself from his column. Now that he's moved, a glaze of light shines on the pillar's black marble. There are just a few customers. My gaze wanders onto the surface of the window. On the glass, people and things appear distorted. The glass shapes them. The glass is a mirror, a falling wave. And although I'm familiar with this place, I'm now lost between its exterior and interior. I'm confused by the reflection of a woman in a red dress, and I wonder if I saw her already, standing at the bottom of the stairs or in the lobby of the cinema. But what's the difference? What does it matter if she was here or there? Women are alone wherever they stand. Her red dress reminds me of my first wife.
But of course, it can't be her, unless it's her ghost. But I don't believe in ghosts. Only ghosts believe in themselves.
My translation's called Four Seasons with Two Summers. First season. I bought a device that can switch off over 700 models of television. It has two modes, non-stealth and stealth. It fits inconspicuously onto my keychain. This would be my favorite cafe bar if the televisions were off. One shows Iranian soap operas and the other Arabic news. There are long mirrors that the barman uses to surreptitiously watch them. He faces outward as though awaiting an order, but his mind is somewhere else. Two. The cafe bar is cave-themed. It is called the Long Dark Cave, and the walls are papier-mâché or polystyrene painted brown. There are nooks and bumps. Stalactites hang beside the televisions. On the way to the bathroom, there's a tiny man-made waterfall. It is strange that I described the televisions before I mentioned the cave theme. Every year it wins the Gazette's award for best themed cafe bar. The mirrors face each other, making it look like there are many hundreds of interconnected chambers. London has man-made tunnels, but no cave systems. It has hills, but no mountains, and it rarely experiences extreme weather. It's the week before Christmas, so they've sprayed fake snow on the windows. Three. The TV news is loud and the internal speaker is distorting. I worry for the bartender's ears, particularly his left. He only hears the soap opera when a character is involved in something big like a car accident. His interest lies in high drama beyond language. There is a quite beautiful woman at the far end of the bar eating Turkish breakfast and watching the Iranian soap. My device is in stealth mode. I calculate the angles so that my signal bounces off the mirror behind the bar, then off the opposite mirror before hitting the far television. I am clearly a dead eye as the soap opera immediately disappears. The quite beautiful woman squints. It was getting to a good bit. She has a slice of cucumber in her right hand that she throws down on her plate. She points to the black screen and calls the barman by his full name. I usually call him Buddy. I'm smiling at my hands because the cafe is nearly its perfect self. While he is looking for the remote, I turn off the news as well.
I did a fairly literal translation of Joe's version. I just wanted it to sound very casual and nice, and I kept everything because there's no money in writing novels in Italy, so I've been a translator for a decade, and I'm sloppy but loyal to the text. I only do it once. I never go back. But that one time, I'm very loyal to the text. So I'll read a very short bit. Quattro stagioni, due estati. Prima stagione. 1. Londra. Comprato apparecchio che spegne 700 e passa modelli di televisore. A due setting. Non-stealth e stealth. I like keeping English words in my translations. A due setting. Non-stealth e stealth. Non ingombra, lo tengo nel portachiavi. Questo sarebbe il mio bar preferito se tenesse spenti i televisori. Uno dà le soap iraniane e l'altro il TG arabo. Ci sono lunghi specchi da cui il barista guarda la TV di nascosto, cioè è rivolto alla sala come aspettasse gli ordini ma ha lo sguardo perso. Il bar è a tema, si chiama La Caverna. È lungo e stretto e i muri sono di cartapesta o polistirolo e dipinti di marrone, con rientranze e protuberanze. Accanto ai televisori pendono delle stalattiti. Prima del bagno c'è una cascatella artificiale. È strano che ho descritto i televisori prima di dire che è un bar a tema.
And we'll actually never know if Francesco was loyal because the next version by Venda La Vida, which is called Four Seasons, Two Summers, begins, I'm just going to give you the first sentence, begins, Stockholm. I'm at the Bar Riche waiting for Ulrika, who is an au pair for my neighbour's family. Francesco, I want to start. You describe, you know, in your commentary, you say that you've been a translator, and you say that you always want to be very literal. You say trying to give your aim is always to try and give sentences a sense of wholeness, being very literal. And then there are two moments that I noticed, though, where you're not literal. Where there's a moment where Joe describes his thingy, and you say that actually you don't translate it as that. And then you say, but I don't care. And I don't care because writers are not translators. I don't think they're really interested in meaning. They're more interested in sound.
Oh, you mean the sentence about the stealth thing where I explain what the thingy is?
Yeah.
Yeah, the thing is, I recently translated John Jeremiah Sullivan's Pulphead. And in this decade of translation work, publishing houses often gave me a hard time. You know, don't keep this word or don't change this. And then I figured out that when the writer is actually alive, I can call him and convince him to change it. And every time I do that, writers are always okay with me because they say, I explain how ugly it sounds in Italian if I translate it. They say, no, I don't want it to sound like that. So like every one of you has got their other versions of themselves sounding really ugly elsewhere because some translator really wants to keep the meaning right. So every time you ask a writer, okay, this is the way it sounds in Italian, and I just give a very ugly sounding version. I say, no, please don't keep it like that. Let's change it. I say, so you change it. Okay, so, and this is what I did with my translation, with my American editor, which is actually English. We changed a lot of jokes because they couldn't just be translated. And and my translator wasn't even involved in that because he didn't want to change it. So we did it ourselves. So I think being unloyal in a way is being loyal when you cannot keep the sense that writing is good and awesome and handsome. Okay, so translators are often against handsome.
No, just Antonia, do you think that are those two positions contradictory, or do you think there's a way in which you're saying that, that your position of that the writer, that literality, as it were, is crucial?
No, I would accept what you said, that you can argue about whether something sounds really terrible if literally translated. I'd like to offer you an example of a problem which is related to that. Philip Hensher and I tend to write dialogue that goes, he said, she said, she said, he said. We use the verb said. Neither of us can persuade our French editors to do any such thing. It has to be remarque, cria, and so on. And they will not. And it looks horrible to me because I think in English you shouldn't keep putting these over-emotional verbs in. And the French say it is so ugly if you just say detail, detail. Mm. And that's what
I take that out. In Italian, I often take the he said, she said out. It's just really impossible to read.
Well, this is something to do with the rhythm of the language itself, which one also has to respect. But nevertheless, when I read it in French, it makes me feel slightly ill.
You had a problem with repetition in your translation, you told me once.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, actually, French seems to be one of the problems because they have a very set idea of what is good style. And so even when you say, no, but I know this is slightly deliberately odd, it's much more odd in the French, and therefore it's therefore not quite right. And it's interesting that I actually, one thing's in a recent Paris Review piece that Lydia Davis wrote about her translation of Madame Bovary, she says something very similar where she says, there is something about the formality of the French that I find compelling, or perhaps what I find compelling is that even if the French is more formal out of limited resources, its formality is part of its distinctive character, and I would be very hesitant to change that, even if an equivalent formality in English is not really equivalent, but more formal, because we are, in our tradition, less formal. and that seems to be basically the same problem. But Joe, because you then also say that you hope... Actually, I think you need to explain slightly your translation method, because it was slightly different to some people's.
Well, I should also explain... And Adam knew this when he asked me to translate from French, that I don't speak French. So that was stage one. And also, I don't think you said to me, what was the phrase you used earlier on, that you whatever feels the most authentic? I believe you used the word explode. and so I was I was going into it with no sense of loyalty to the original.
To a Frenchman.
And you know, I only have schoolboy French. I could probably order a croissant. And so...
In a restaurant.
In a restaurant. And I put it into Google Translate, as I think lots of people in this book use Google Translate, but basically for me it was just Google Translate. And the original story, as you hear if you read Rawi's one, is quite an existential story that relies a lot on tone. And putting an existential story that relies on tone through Google Translate, you probably don't need to be told, doesn't result in a very appealing story. And so I was left with either choosing to try and do what I suspected would be a very, very bad job of authentically translating the story, and either that or do, which is what I did do, is decide to completely scrap it and have the French story I worked on just appear through the story in the cracks, like the TVs in my story are translated lines. And so it's like, it's more that the French version is a kind of one of a number of voices that creep through.
And then just to finish, then I think we'll have to open it to questions. You do then finish saying that you hope that something of the original is still there. Now that you've read them, do you feel your hope was justified?
No. No, I don't. And, you know, I think if I could go back, I think I would, even though I'm sure I would do a bad job, I think I would prefer to do the real translation, even if it resulted in a terrible story.
Although you wrote
story.
A really good short story.
Well, I like my story, but it has no... The relationship with the original is so strange and unhelpful.
Everyone hates Arabic existentialism, I think. This was a strong reaction by everyone.
Only Rawi liked this story, it's true. Every single writer I sent this to said, can I change it?
How many writers did you send it to?
Well, I mean, no one said no, but I just mean each person who said yes said, I'm going to change it.
Right.
I think we should open it out to you. Talk to us. I don't know whether you... How we'll do this.
There's one more chair.
Just come up. Tash, do you want to... Come up.
I'll pass the mic around, but if you can give it straight back to me and I'll get it back to the panel so they can all answer.
I've got a question for you, Adam.
Yeah.
You don't seem to have been motivated by finding writers who actually spoke the languages they're translating into very well. why did you choose the writers you chose to translate?
Actually, I think this has given us slightly... in fact, I'd say probably most people did speak it fluently or near fluently. I'd say two or three people, like Joe, you might have been one of probably the worst. it's true that certainly, so when I'm saying not fluent, I'm not meaning kind of absolutely no knowledge. I'm simply meaning these were people who wouldn't necessarily have thought of themselves as being adequately equipped. That's all I mean. So that while their knowledge was good, some people were bilingual. I mean, basically bilingual, you know, like there's not, I'd say a lot were bilingual, and that was part of one of the motivations for it was realizing how many of my friends and how many writers I knew were bilingual for various reasons. You know, Gary Steingart is kind of speaks both Russian and English, and kind of so, I think we've maybe given an overly kamikaze impression here, that actually most people were, if not fluent, they were pretty competent.
So did you choose
a specific reason? The problem with organising 60 writers is that some of them... So with Gary Steingart, I knew that he liked Daniel Harms, so I chose a story that I thought Gary would like and kind of be short enough for Gary's attention span to actually translate.
And then he
completely changed it. but actually, that one is very interesting because he changed nearly all the details, but in fact, that was a very interesting example, I think, of where the whole point of that story was structure. And so... it didn't matter that he changed, as it were, the nouns, because everything was about... that was one of the most interesting ones for me, I think. But so in, just to finish the question, so in terms of choosing people, it kind of went, well, partly once it was this issue of McSweeney's, we realized that my initial intention had been to go from language to language without necessarily going in and out of English. But then we realized that subscribers to McSweeney's might be a little upset if they couldn't really read anything. So we decided that it would keep going in and out of English as much as possible. That therefore added the constraint of who I could choose each time, because I was therefore, because I wasn't totally kamikaze, I was trying to find people who roughly spoke the language. So it partly meant that there were more French writers in this than I think I would necessarily have chosen if I had a free hand, because that was everyone, and I would have had, as it were, or I would have loved to have had more Russian. Russian writers, it turns out, don't reply to emails for 6 months. So they were too late. So there were things like, so it was a very, like, the amount of happenstance that's in this project is quite huge.
But there's also that, the whole question about translation versus style, which you've talked about at previous sessions, which is how the big question that this throws up is how much someone who's a professional novice, or you know, who writes novels of fiction as their primary job rather than translate as their primary job, how much that style then exerts itself over the skill and the art of translation, and whether or not fiction writers or novelists are able to resist their urges, their sort of fictive urges. Which I think is one of the joys of the...
And it's true, and also I did, because I was really interested in why it was that so few novelists, as it were, did, you know, that a lot of us are used to being translated, but very rarely do translations. And so the kind of, it was like the byproduct of wanting people to be doing the first translation they'd ever done was, therefore, some people were slightly nervous, as it were, about their linguistic abilities.
Having lived with a translator for a few years, I've learned that the translation community can be quite quick to respond to perceived slights or people trespassing on their turf. What kind of response have you had from translators as a whole?
I don't know, actually. I can see the president of the British Centre for Literary Translation in the audience, so I don't know if we want to pass him the mic and he can he can shout at us.
We love this, of course. Well, I think what's quite interesting, and it kind of follows on from what Adam was saying, is actually there are lots of translators in this book, but they just aren't the English language writers. Because when you say that most novelists don't translate, this is true in the English-speaking world, but this isn't true anywhere else,
yeah.
Or at least not in most places. So Maria is quite a nice example, because it's quite hard to find a Spanish novelist who doesn't also translate. So in fact, from our point of view, at least from my point of view, I wouldn't presume to speak on behalf of the clan. actually, there are a lot of translators who are involved in this, and it's quite interesting to see how they work differently from the English language writers for whom this is a sort of a debut. I mean, I think I know a lot of people, a lot of translators who heard the kind of one line description of what this book was and thought, why the hell would you not use translators if this is a nice, big, interesting game about translation? You would think that maybe someone who knows how to translate might be not a completely crazy thought. On the other hand, the moment you read, for example, Adam's introduction, and you get a sense of what of why this choice was made, and specifically, as Tash was just saying, this idea that if you bring novelists in, what you're doing is you're trying to put as much pressure as possible on the style and see what survives. All the translators I've talked to about this, the ones who kind of twitched slightly when they heard the original sort of idea, when you kind of explain, when you give them the two or three or four sentence explanation of why this happened, I think people understand that this is actually quite an interesting and sort of valid, and it's also supposed to be a playful thing, I don't think. Yeah.
So what he's saying is they loved it. Anxious. They love it.
Yes.
It's true that the other thing I found interesting about reading it, it's a very strange object to read. I mean, I don't know if you could read it kind of all the way through. You might get crazy. But this question of style is, at what point, I find it very interesting kind of whether you create a collective style for each story. Kind of at what point is Tash's version of Marjan's version of Zaidi's version of the original Italian? Are you creating, is Tash's version just Tash's style? Or is it in some way some weird amalgam of everybody? I think that's one of the things that, and it's kind of an unanswerable question, but it was certainly one of the things I was interested in. I mean, like, I'm just, did any of you... So in a sense, I think everyone... Antonia, you must be the one in a way who was trying most to find another style that wouldn't be the normal way you'd write, it sounds like.
So I think I have a simple passion for words, and I don't normally think of my style. Mm-hmm. I look at a different level for the right word for this sentence. So if I'm, which means I can write, I hope, different sorts of sentences in different contexts. When I'm translating, I want to write the sort of sentences that are in the text as they stand. And yeah. So I don't have the latitude, I don't allow myself the latitude to improve a sentence. I used to have terrible rows with my unfortunately now dead French translator about this, because he would occasionally ring up and he would say, this sentence I think is meaningless. So I would say, no, it isn't. It's perfectly all right. Just translate it. So he said, on your head be it. And we went on like that. But in fact, I didn't read his translations, and they were apparently so embroidered. but they worked. I think it really is. I have this sort of word-by-word respect for words. And style is a thing I never think about. So, in a sense, the whole project, you know, your idea that perhaps we might find a communal sense of what style was, leaves me trottling along at my one word at a time level, sort of not with you.
There's a gentleman at the back.
Sorry, I'll stand up. The thing that excited me when I heard what you were talking about, Adam, so I think we've got a lot of feedback here, so can I just project? The thing that excited me was the idea of replication of the oral tradition, that there was a story that existed which a number of people was doing, a number of different serial media, produced versions. So it wasn't so much to do with style, it was to do with some combination of style and content and just seeing what survived. And that's exactly what we got from the little vignettes. Very exciting project for that reason.
So the question,
Adam, sorry, yeah, sorry, you're going to summarise for us. Sorry, carry on.
For those of you, so it's basically you were saying about that for you the interest was, as it were, some kind of going back to an oral tradition where various versions would be made almost by memory, as it were, of kind of the same story. Which reminds me that one of my favourite of the, I think the least justified translation method was Sjorn's, the Icelandic writer. If I can quickly find it, he describes what he did. And Sjorn was translating a Dutch original at about six removes by the time he'd got to it, and he was technically meant to be translating Jeff Eugenides. And this is what Sjorn did. Floki Sigur Jonsson, my 13-year-old son and a native Icelandic speaker, was given half an hour to memorize Jeffrey Eugenides' translation. I refrained from reading the source text. 3 weeks after listening to Flocky's oral retelling of Jeffrey's story, I wrote it down from memory. I have not compared the two. So I suppose there's the pure... You've got an Icelandic saga in miniature in that story. Yeah, it's true. I don't know. I mean, I suppose it's true that, in a sense, what's really at stake is what survives, and it's true that style is one way of talking about it, but... it's intriguing, actually, what content survived as well. Like, it always amuses me in Marjan's vein that thermal valve survives somehow rather pure. And whereas
that was the one word I had to look up, because it became the translation from the...
Is there no mic?
From the English, it speaks no Chinese. And that was... Thermal valves was the one word I had to look up in the dictionary.
Okay. But yeah, and even in Wendler, so Wendler Vida, when she did her version of Francesco, she did a, the way she describes it, she did a basically a literal version and then decided that, like everybody, she hated the original story. and so she completely just wrote a new story, but with that in her mind. But then what is intriguing is she said she wrote it a long time after the original, kind of her first translation, but then in retrospect realised that there are actually many details of the story that she wanted to write anyway, that was basically a short story she'd been meaning to write, and yet there were kind of structural details of mother-in-laws and dead mother-in-laws and kind of... So there's something kind of weird about it. And I think... the other word I think I was quite interested in is tone as well. Like, I think, Tash, at one point you talk about tuning in to Ma Jen's version. And one thing that does interest me is in how many of these things where it really should have got utterly destroyed, often millions of details are gone, but the tone has actually remained the same.
Because I think what I was tapping into was that same radio frequency, because Ma Jen said earlier about how he located the Chineseness in Zadie's story. And I think that's to do with tone. It's a curtain. I mean, the story is about isolation and loneliness and someone who's sort of quite rootless in quite a rapidly changing world. And he tapped into that, and I tapped into that, I think. And that's why I think that group of stories remains tonally quite unified.
While being very different.
Yeah, while being very different.
Because the story was good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Any more questions? Or is that?
Hi, my name is Ben. Adam, you choose your subject very well, I have to say. For me, this was not a wasted evening. No applause, okay. What I kind of miss is basically how you define translating. So I could sort of come up with a few things, like from the legal world. If you have a text, you can have an historical interpretation. You can go by the word, by the text itself. You can go by, things like history, the historical interpretation. And of course, what was the intention of the writer? And then, you know, the receiver, the language it's translated into has to be kind of understood. So, I mean, all these aspects play a role in, I would say, translation. The fascinating thing I find about translating a translation into another translation to, of course, compare the beginning and the end, and it happens to be in English, well, fine. So, I mean, that's one of the fascinating things. And it's also like you could compare that with oral history. If you look for people for your project, go to the Netherlands. They speak at least two languages apart from their own, usually three or four. So maybe that would help.
Well, we have three Dutch writers in this anthology. We have A.L. Schneiders is one of the originals, and then Sees Noteboom does one of the translations, and Arnon Grunberg. It's true that who both speak 17 languages fluently. I think I don't know if I want to give a definition of translation, because I think the point of this was to think, absolutely, the ideal should be the replica, as it were, but then since it can never be a replica, a book I've liked very much recently is David Bellos, who's a very good translator, his book on translation, where he says the most you can hope for is that it's a likeness in certain ways, and you'll have to you can never match the original in every way, because it's quite literally a different language. So you have to choose where the likeness should be. And I think what I found, I suppose the issue which I think has come up a lot tonight, which is I think the real interest for me, is it's even with the best of intentions to, as it were, if the ideal is just to get the same thing into the new language, often that might involve changing it. And that's the kind of, that's the deep paradox of it. And it really depends. The other thing I found interesting about this is really the ethical problem, because I think Antonio, you're absolutely right. I think there's a question of property here, of whose text this is, which in one sense is obvious, which is it's the original writer's. But I think there's a very interesting thing to me of the difference between the ethics of it. If you're a kind of novelist translator, novelists obviously feel slightly more able to plunder and steal, as opposed to translators, who it seems to me are more morally careful. But at the same time, they have the same problem, which is they'll never be able to do the soi-disant perfect translation.
Can I ask a question?
Yes. Not to me.
Yes, to you. Oh. What instructions did you give everyone? Just from pure. It seems to be that the instructions vary.
Like, I think they did vary they varied simply if people kept on emailing me back with more questions, so then I was forced into more. I think it's true that occasionally I was a bit more provocative, so it's true that with the Rowie Haga story that no one liked,
I got more and more desperate, and so I think I did start to get more and more expensive. And just so I may well have used the word explode. I don't know. it doesn't sound like a word I'd use.
It's also worth explaining to everyone that the which I don't think has been properly explained, which is that we were doing blind translation. So I wasn't allowed to bring up Flora or Maijian and say, what did you mean by this word? Which you normally, if you're working with a writer, you would be able to. You'd say, actually, where was this person born? I mean, what is the context? So we weren't allowed any communication, and we were only just given a text.
Yeah, the intention was to entirely cripple you all. That's definitely true.
Can I say something?
You've got to all stop talking to me.
No, not to you. About what is translation in this context. In Adam's defense, I want to say that this book has two points, I think. One is there's a huge market of translated literature, and nobody ever checks what is happening there. So, like, in the English-speaking words, less stuff is read in translation. But, for example, in Italy, like I have a good look of what is happening to English being translated, and I know that it's not a very good picture, that every publishing house has a way of cheating on what sort of English they want to have in Italian. And for example, the publishing house I started translating with were friends of mine, like Rick Moody, David Foster Wallace, and George Saunders sort of sound the same. And no one really talks about it. So in a way, we have to make asses of ourselves in order to bring that up, because it can be a source of interest and enjoyment, but you have to be open about it. So the market goes on, even the distinguished market goes on, and no one ever says anything about it. We make a fools of ourselves, and we bring the process up. Okay. And the other thing is the thing about the oral tradition. Like, we want to see what sticks and what's interesting about a story. It can be a sentence, it can be the turn of a phrase, and it can be the story, the subject matter. Sometimes you talk about a book you're reading in another language, and you get people's attention just by saying what the book is about. And sometimes you have to read a line. So there's many treasures, and this book goes to show that it's not always the one thing that matters. That's always different things. So you don't have to be rigid about it.
It's just that the fact that you chose creative writers to do translations, I would have thought that it was their duty as creative writers to actually interpret things creatively and to add their own slant. Otherwise, it seems as though why wasn't it translators who were translating the story if it was meant to be kind of a replica or truthful translation? Surely as creative writers that you've chosen, isn't that their duty to be creative on the slant?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if anyone said the duty was. I mean, it's true that the reason for, I think it was more of the reason for choosing writers was really to think that these people who are so used to writing in their own voice, and what would happen if they were kind of basically forced into potentially not writing in that voice, or what would they would they then morph the thing back to sound like them? See, for me, like, I think I'd more prefer the word freedom of, like, yes, they have a kind of, you know, but basically it was the freedom of the project itself, because they weren't being paid to do a, they weren't working for Penguin Classics, as it were, or, you know, that there was no employer-employee relationship here where they had a certain duty, so they were free in that sense. So, yeah, the game was definitely with rewriting almost rather than just writing.
I mean, if you were a creative writer, and creative is a word I never use, if you were a writer, why not write your own story rather than mess up somebody else's?
Okay, 我现在举一个例子, 这有一支笔, 我给大家, 每人一支笔, 你们来画我。 我想你们每个人看到的我都不一样。
So, if I give this pen to each one of you and you draw a picture of me, each one of your pictures will be different.
我的意思说，当我那个看到了那个英国的亨利摩尔摆到了香港的这个那个广场上的时候，我发现它变成了一个标本，它不再是那个原来的那个作品。因为我到了亨利摩尔的雕塑那里看的时候，它完整的是跟它的环境融为一体。
Henry Moore was transplanted to a square in Hong Kong. It became a completely altered thing to how it was when I saw it in the fields, in the garden of Greenwich.
我想这个我们这个世界，我们可以活在同一个时间，但是我们活在不是在一个同一个时代。所以我认为这个语言后面的故事并不是一个作家他想要表达的，也许是很多作家都可以通过他的语言表达的，这正是这本书最有意思的一点。
What is interesting in this process of translation is that the essence that somehow survives each sequence of the message that the writer is trying to put forth and that can be conveyed in a whole variety of ways.
但是我承认，如果是一个作家的话，他的这个创造性比他的翻译的能力可能更强，他更愿意在这个作家的情况下。理解这个翻译的灵魂，他更走在一个语言的极端，应该是这样的。
But as a writer, attempting this task of translation, there is always that desire to go to push language to its extremes to see how far you can take it. What that desire to break boundaries.
Should we stop there? Is that, I don't know how much time.
Yeah, I think we're all done, aren't we? Thank you very much for your questions. Thank you all for your patience with our lack of microphones and the feedbacky stuff. Thank you, Adam, and the Multiples panel. Thank you very much. Thank you. The books are on sale. We have...a really interesting programme of events coming up over the autumn, so do sign up for our email newsletter if you haven't already. And we also do a strand, our World Literature series, which covers and investigates all sorts of interesting elements about translation. So there are events coming up, and there are events that have already passed, that we've recorded, that will be featured on our new website for our 10th birthday, woo, in mid-October, I believe. So sign up, look at the website, and hopefully listen to the event again if we can get it online. Again, thanks very much.